I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's June 21st, and we have a lot to talk about. June is Pride Month, and it's the perfect time to talk about some of the issues and some of the obstacles faced by members of the LGBTQ+ community in trying to access MS care. And we'll look at these issues by first talking with Dr. William Conti, an MS specialist practicing outside of the Chicago area. Then we'll hear from Patience Nagashima, a queer transgender person living with MS. And finally, we'll hear about some of the work that the National MS Society's Healthcare Access Team does to ensure greater health equity for underserved communities. I met with Dr. Conti just a few weeks ago at the Consortium of MS Centers annual meeting, and in a moment, we'll hear our conversation. I'm here at the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers annual meeting, and I'm talking with Dr. William Conti. Dr. Conti is an MS specialist in the Chicago area. He's a former Sylvia Lowry Fellow, and he's here at the conference presenting on some of the unique challenges faced by LGBTQ+ people who are living with multiple sclerosis. But before we get to your presentation today, Dr. Conti, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what being a Sylvia Lowry Fellow is all about.
Okay, thanks for having me, John. So a fellow, first of all, a fellowship is optional training following a residency, right? So medical education, you go to college, then medical school, then, you know, after medical school, you are a physician, right? So then physicians need to do a residency following that, which is then their specialization. So for me, I did a neurology residency. I could have entered practice following that. However, I chose to become a subspecialist in multiple sclerosis, which, at the time I did a fellowship. So, you know, fellowships could be, you know, 1, 2, 3 years, and it's extra training. So Sylvia Lowry Fellowship is sponsored by the National MS Society, with the goals of having the fellows both understand the clinical treatment and management and diagnosis of many neuroimmunological disorders, including MS, but also, you know, be trained as researchers, clinical researchers, if you will. So, you know, in a given week, I was going to clinic probably about half the time. The other half of the time was split between doing clinical research and also taking classes. And ultimately, I got a master's in public health sciences at the conclusion of my fellowship. You know, I had a thesis and everything.
And I guess I should point out for some of my listeners who may not be familiar with the name Sylvia Lowry, Sylvia Lowry actually is the founder of the National MS Society. So let's fast forward to earlier today. You were part of a presentation, and one of the big takeaways, certainly, was the fact that it was pointed out 245 studies have shown evidence that LGBTQ+ discrimination actually leads to adverse health outcomes. Can you talk about what some of those outcomes are?
Right. So LGBTQ+ people face health challenges and health disparities more so than you know, cisgender heterosexual people do. And there's two theories I have for that. One is there is a body of evidence that adverse childhood experiences can lead to adult onset of problems with health. So LGBTQ+ people, they have higher rates of disability, higher rates of physical limitations, higher healthcare utilization, higher rates of cancer, cardiovascular disease, and higher rates of mental health issues and addictions. And so one of the theories is that due to adverse childhood experiences, it could be something as subtle as not feeling supported or, in a family, for example, you know, hiding who you were. And, across the board, people who are LGBTQ+ report higher rates of adverse childhood experiences than other people do.
And that initial early childhood or childhood or adolescent trauma is what actually sets a table for some of those health challenges that get faced later.
By trauma, I mean, obviously, you know, children, I mean, there could be physical, emotional, sexual abuse, but it could be a lot more subtle, where you have to hide who you are because of fear of rejection, and it could be over time cause a lot of problems with their experiences. And there's another theory called minority stress theory, where discriminatory practices will affect, cause stress on an LGBTQ plus person. It could be something as subtle as bullying or interpersonal problems, but it also could be more societal impacts. And it just mere exposure to it, even if they're not directly affected by either the interpersonal or societal challenges, can cause overall something called minority stress over time.
So someone who may be the victim or have been the victim of minority stress growing up, they arrive at the clinic. What does a clinician need to be thinking about to provide the kind of care those people need?
You know, I'm not suggesting that LGBTQ plus people should be treated differently than other people. But the problem is that because we face, you know, more health disparities, that there might be an intersection between, you know, these health disparities intersecting with the MS care, right? So, like I said earlier, if LGBTQ plus people face more high rates of disability, right? So what about MS patients? MS patients face higher rates of disability. So when you combine the two, I think clinicians need to be more aware of being aware of the challenges so that they can take action earlier.
Speaking of taking action, something else that you brought up earlier in your presentation was talking about certain disease-modifying therapies not always being the best first choice for someone who may be HIV positive. Can you talk a little bit about what some of those risks are?
So I think there's a perception amongst neurologists, even MS specialists, that a person who is HIV positive should be on a, quote, low efficacy therapy because it's, quote, safer. And there's actually a little bit of a misconception here. So I do want to emphasize that being HIV positive is not unique to the LGBTQ plus population. However, we do face higher rates of that infection amongst this community. So pretty much all of the clinical trials for MS have excluded patients who are HIV positive, which it's still happening to this day in the newer studies, and it's 2022 right now. And I think there's a misconception that all because you're HIV positive doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to be at higher risk for certain health outcomes, because there's really two types of HIV positive people. You know, there's a recently diagnosed HIV positive patients with a high viral load, non-antiviral medicines, low CD4 count, right? So that's very different than someone who's had chronic HIV, who has an undetectable viral load, who has normal lymphocyte counts, normal CD4 counts. I think that patient should be offered best-in-class therapy. And I think it's excluding these patients from the clinical trials actually has this downstream effect, that some labels for the drugs have HIV as a contraindication, not for the best reasons sometimes, and it becomes this, you know, misconception amongst the neurologists that we have to treat them differently.
Your presentation today broadly addressed disparities that exist when it comes to healthcare for the LGBTQ plus community. What has to change?
So while it is true, I think as a whole, the American society has been a little bit more accepting of LGBTQ plus people in most situations. However, we do face a lot of, you know, discrimination across the world. We face a lot of almost harassment from certain people, and that creates the health disparity. So how do we address that? I mean, I'm not going to be able to change everybody's opinions on how, you know, they feel about, you know, the LGBTQ plus community. However, I think that the medical field should be a little bit more reactive to, you know, the potential health challenges that we face.
Well, Dr. William Cotty, I want to thank you for shining a bright light on a subject that we're just beginning to address in a proactive way. Presentations like yours are a great step in the right direction, and hopefully there'll be steps to follow. Thanks so much for being at the conference, for presenting, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks, John.
Patience Nagashima has spent years as a health equity activist. In my conversation with Patience, we'll hear about how for some people living with MS, an appointment with their healthcare provider can start to go sideways before they even see the doctor. I hope you'll excuse some of the background noise that was taking place during my conversation with Patience, but it was an important conversation, and in a moment, we'll meet Patience Nagashima. In their blog, Patience Nagashima describes himself as a half-Japanese, queer, trans person living with MS. And today, we're talking about access and inclusivity in healthcare. Welcome to the podcast, Patience.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you for having me.
I think everyone can think back to their initial visit to any doctor's office. Before you ever see the doctor, you're asked to fill out a bunch of required forms. It's the very first thing that happens. And in your experience, when you're handed those forms, well, things begin to go sideways. Can you tell me a little about that?
Yeah, so as a trans person, and I have not had my government name changed yet. So my government name is... It is very feminine. And the very top line, right, on every form, the very first thing they're going to ask you is for your government name. And then normally to the right is the little box that either says sex or gender, and it's only M or F. And for a long time, I would just scratch that out and write yes or something and just sort of ignore that whole piece. But what was happening in those situations is from the very first thing, I'm excluded, I'm erased, and I'm uncomfortable. And the rest of the form just goes downhill from there. So before I would even walk into a doctor's office, knowing that this was coming, I was already going to be anxious. I was going to be anxious because I knew that they would use my government name when they called me, and that I would be sitting in a very masculine presenting, and that I would be sitting in a waiting room, and all of a sudden they would say this very, very feminine name, and then I get up and everybody's going to look at me. So it's always been a tough experience.
What other aspects of interacting with the healthcare system have you found either frustrating or, as you just perfectly described, anxiety producing?
So prior to my diagnosis, so it took about 5 years for me to be diagnosed with MS. Very early on in that process, I was on disability. It was very hard to get in to see any specialist, right? And I remember I had waited about 6 months to go in to see a rheumatologist. And I went in there with my partner at the time, and we're having this, you know, great conversation, very, very thorough, and I'm, you know, trying to get an answer for what's going on with me. And then she finds out that I'm queer, right? And okay, started asking me some different questions, and I'm like, I'm in a monogamous relationship. I'm also regularly tested for STIs, all this type of stuff. Okay, everything's fine. And then she ordered a lot of lab work, and so go up, you know, get the lab work done, have the follow-up appointment, and discovered that 90% of the lab work she had done was for STIs. Totally not related to anything, even though I had said, you know, that I'm regularly tested, but made that assumption, right? Made that, put me in that stereotype, and made that assumption, and basically wasted my time and my money in doing that. And obviously I got no answer. So I waited 6 months to get pigeonholed. And that would be another thing that would make it difficult for me to go out and seek treatment or seek care. It's like, it's not worth that.
Talk to me about how we can make the healthcare experience more inclusive so that people don't have to struggle over trying to fit themselves into the right box.
I think it starts with, you know, education for practitioners, right? We're not a box. You know, we're not a monolith. You know, these assumptions are not going to work. The first steps for patient-centered care should come through conversation. You know, like, talk to me. Like, as a person, not a body to be addressed, right? But as a person. And then in that process of just having a human-centered, patient-centered conversation, you know, I found that I've become more comfortable. I've become more willing to be active in making decisions about my healthcare. I've become more willing to ask more questions instead of just feeling like I have to be processed through a thing, right? So yeah, I think that's for me the very, very first step. Inclusive forms are helpful. Office procedural policies where people can use their name, not their government name, because let's face it, it's not just trans people that don't use their government name. A lot of people have nicknames. You know, a lot of people don't like their government name. There's a lot of simple things I think that can be done.
So someone goes for their first appointment with a new neurologist or specialist or really any doctor at all. And they get a sense that things aren't feeling quite right, that the experience starting off, as you've explained, as you've described, is not as inclusive as it needs to be. Is there anything in that moment a patient can do to try to put things on a better footing without having to be the ones to deliver the lecture to the doctor?
So I think it starts before the first appointment. You know, as a queer person of color, when I am looking for a new physician today, I'm not just looking for any specialist. If I can find a queer person of color as my physician, that is what I want and prefer. Or I reach out and find recommendations on queer friendly practices or queer-centered practices sometimes. So I always start there before I move forward. Now, if there are no options, which does happen sometimes, at that point, you know, you still have the first, you can kind of get a sense just from the first phone calls and making the appointments. You know, I recently just went through that process and, you know, just making the appointment, they did ask me about my pronouns. Now, they didn't have a office policy in place to use that, but the person that was making the appointment did use my pronouns, right? So that gave me a little bit of hope. When it does start to go south, though, for me, I will attempt to reach back out. I mean, I am spending my money, right? I need the service for a reason, and see what can happen with that. There are, most of the time, what ends up happening though is I don't go back, and I do let them know why I don't go back. It is upon the healthcare provider to educate themselves, and they should be educated by people that are of the community. Talk to a trans doctor that works with people, right? Or something like that. Talk to people within the community. Get that information from people within the community. We have our own voices. We can speak for ourselves.
Inclusivity might start out as a policy, but to really gain footing, it needs to be more than a policy. It needs to be an attitude. And I'm wondering, is this something that needs to be presented and taught, if necessary, in medical school?
So some schools are already doing that, which I'm really, really glad to see. Actually, I know a person who is a out trans man and just got his MD. And actually the medical school that he went to, you know, they really centered around that. And it's really funny. His mother is actually, she was my doctor for hormones for my transition. And one of the things that happened during that time is she worked at another clinic and has been doing trans care for a long time, and started having the other students do rotations with her at that center so that they would be experiencing working with, you know, transgender people. So there are things out there like that, right? WPATH, USPATH has things out there for trans care. So it's available.
Patients, I want to thank you for being loud and proud of who you are, and in doing that, helping to shape a healthcare system that's welcoming and comfortable for everyone. And I want to thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
While I was at the Consortium of MS Centers annual meeting, I also had a chance to catch up with Andrina Barnola. Andrina is the Director of Health Equity Initiatives for the National MS Society. And in a moment, we'll hear my conversation with Andrina. We are live at the Consortium of MS Centers annual meeting. We're at the National MS Society's booth here in the exhibit hall, and I have the good fortune to be speaking with Andrina Barnola, MPH. Andrina is the Director of Health Equity Initiatives at the National MS Society. Welcome to the podcast, Andrina.
Hello, John. Thank you for the invitation. I'm thrilled to be here with you today.
I sometimes wonder whether my listeners really know all the ways that the Society provides outreach to healthcare providers, to the doctors and neurologists that they see. And so I thought maybe before we get into a little more detailed conversation, you can kind of tell us a little bit about what the healthcare access team is all about.
Wonderful. So, John, the healthcare access team is part of the advocacy and healthcare access umbrella. And within the healthcare access team, we have two big teams. One of the teams, the stakeholder engagement team, and that is the team that does the work. As you said, they reach out to providers. It could be MS specialists, general neurologists, and engage them with a society and provide them with the tools and resources they need to treat their patients with living with multiple sclerosis. And then on the other hand, the healthcare access team also has the clinical innovation team. That's the one that I'm part of. And it has like two components. One is the clinical programs and resources team that's dedicated to creating information for healthcare providers to better treat their patients. And then the health equity team that was recently created to provide equal access to care for everyone affected by MS.
Now maybe we can drill down a little bit more, because I know one of the things that you're personally involved in every day is the concept of health equity. And maybe you can talk a little bit about the health equity initiatives that the Society is championing.
Absolutely. So within the healthcare access team, we're trying to make impact in five main areas. So the first area is promoting MS workforce development, and we're doing that in three specific ways. The first one is the MS Clinical Mentorship Program, and the idea of that program is to expose medical students to MS diagnosis and MS care. This year, the Society had 72 applicants to that program, and 25 students were paired with 25 sites. Additionally, this program is marketed around 400 places like the Indian Health Services, like Puerto Rico, and like historically black colleges and universities. The second place we're working on is the Society's Clinical Fellowship Program, and that is to train providers to be MS specialists. And within that, we're doing health equity work by including cultural competence training within the curriculum of the fellowship program. And the third piece of that area is the ECHO MS program. And ECHO includes ECHO MS and the International Pediatric MS program. And the idea is to engage general neurologists and even other healthcare providers to provide them information and knowledge on how to diagnose and treat people with multiple sclerosis.
I think that is so, so important. I know in an awful lot of communities, the community neurologist, if there even is one, may not be an MS specialist, but the Society is very much involved in reaching out to them so that they really can help their patients who are living with MS in spite of the fact that they don't have that specialization.
Yes, absolutely. And that is the second area that I was going to talk about, which is targeted outreach engagement. This year, the Society launched the first General Neurologist National Initiative, and the stakeholder team is reaching out to neurologists across the country, and we're aiming to increase the number, as you said, of general neurologists that can diagnose and treat properly patients living with multiple sclerosis.
I think that's great, because so many people don't necessarily live in or near a major metropolitan area. They may not be seeing someone who is affiliated with an academic institution, and still they certainly deserve the very best care.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully in the future, after general neurologists, we'll be able to expand this work, you know, to work with primary care providers or even emergency rooms, because we know there's a group of people that they have to go to a primary care provider before being diagnosed with MS. So hopefully that's coming in the future.
That sounds great. Let me ask you a different kind of question. Tell me what you love most about what you get to do.
Well, to be honest, coming from a developing country, I've been, like, from lived experiences, I know how people struggle to get care. And for me, it is very rewarding to see the different ways in which we could move the needle and make a difference and help people that really can't access care and quality care. So anything that we can do to move that forward, I'm so happy, and that's what makes me happy.
Andrina Barnola, thanks for coming to work every day to move the needle, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you, John, for the invitation.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/251. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes, and you'll be able to save your favorite episodes. It's also a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.